You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth!
You can't handle the truth!
Dave Hodges is as mad as hell, and he's not gonna take it anymore.
I'd like to help you, Doctor, if I really knew you would, but the din in my head, it's too much and it's no good. I'm standing in a windy tunnel, shouting through the roar, and I'd like to give you information, asking for love, but blood makes noise. It's ringing in my ear, blood makes noise, and I can't really hear you in the thickening of fear.
Common sense is not so common. This is the Common Sense Show with Dave Hodges.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to another exciting edition of the Common Sense Show. I am your host, Dave Hodges, and we come to you at this time every Sunday evening from 5 p.m. to 8 p.m. on Pacific and West Coast time zone, and we also come to you at this time 8 p.m. to 11 p.m. East Coast. We got a really action-packed show for you tonight. Let me just say this before we go any further. Can you believe it's been 52 years? 52 years since what? Since JFK was assassinated? 52 years. And to me, that was the watershed event that really set the New World Order into motion. We're going to talk about, in the last half hour, we being Jim White and myself, are going to talk about a little about the Kennedy assassination, but not about dredging up old history. And we're not going to get into the forensics of, the magic bullet and the timing problem. We're going to get into what happened then, why it was done, who did it, and more importantly, how is this still with us today, last half hour? And of course, Katie is going to be on in the first half of the third hour, and she's going to be discussing the latest in health trends. And there's no shortage. Her show last week was a classic. What the FDA does not want you to know about treating breast cancer. And I have posted that particular segment to thecommonsenseshow.com, and I invite all of you to go up there. In the second hour, we're going to be joined by both my partner, Jim White, and Mike Adams from Natural News and TalkNetwork.com, and we're going to be talking to you about what Mike is into, but we're also going to get into some of the latest issues regarding to what he's investigating, and we got a couple of surprises that we're going to throw out. I'll just give you a hint. It's called robots, automation, and we don't need that many humans. And in the first hour, and I've been told now that my guest is ready, we've secured his presence, James Wesley Rawls. I've wanted to get James on for a very, 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 very long time. He is well known for basically being at the top of the survivalist pyramid in terms of knowledge. He's well followed on his blog, survivalblog.com, where he is the founder and the senior editor. And he covers a whole genre of survival and preparedness topics. Jim White and I interviewed him over on News Talk Network this past week, and it was a riveting interview, and we're going to touch on some of those same topics just in case you missed that. He's best described as a constitutionalist. I think of him as a good old-fashioned American hero, former Army intelligence, and still serving his country and trying to point out what's wrong and what we need to do to correct it. James, it's really an honor and a privilege to have you on with us here on the Common Sense Show.
Thank you so much for having me on, Dave.
Yeah, it's really our pleasure. Well, I want to get right down to business because our time is short, and you have talked and written a lot about the subject of EMPs, and it seems like no matter how many times I cover this, no matter how many times anybody covers this, the topic just won't go away. Do you think the United States is facing an EMP attack?
I think there's definitely a risk of any of the first and second world nations having the capability. Any nation that has both nuclear technology and access to space is capable of having an EMP attack that would affect the entire United States. Now, if a nation state or a terrorist group were to have access to nuclear weapons but not access to space, then the area of effect would be much smaller, because the EMP footprint is essentially limited to line of sight for the direct effects, although there are some beyond the horizon effects through coupling through things like telephone lines and power lines. But the immediate effects are limited to line of sight, and you only have a really broad line of sight if you are in space.
Well, Congressman Trent Franks is my congressman, and approximately 6 years ago, I attended a town hall meeting that he was invited to, coincidentally held at my place of worship. And in that meeting, Congressman Franks played a 20-minute DOD video in which they described two nuclear weapons being detonated 100 miles up in altitude at mid-continent United States, and they made the claim that nearly every electronic circuit would be fried and America would be thrown into the Dark Ages. Do you agree with that assessment?
Pretty much, although I've got to say that the threat to vehicles is probably a little overstated by some people. With a vehicle, you end up with microcircuits that have a basic level of shielding. Not only do you have your circuitry sitting on four insulators, your tires, but you also have all the circuitry pretty well, unless you're charging your car battery, for example, or you have your electronics plugged into some diagnostics for some reason that are plugged into the internet or power system. Essentially, you have an isolated system with a car. So the EMP effects are going to be less severe for a vehicle than they will be for, say, a radio or a computer that you have plugged in to power at home.
Mm-hmm. What kind of things can the average person do to shield critical possession items? Let's say they're asthmatic and they've got
some really simple things that people can do. The easiest is just go to your local hardware store and buy a brand new 40-gallon galvanized trash can with a tight-fitting lid. And that will form what's called a Faraday cage, Faraday box, and that can isolate any of your small electronics. So that's where you should probably store your spare cell phones, your spare laptops, any radios that you don't currently have to have plugged in at any given time. So any of your spare radios should all go in there. And all you need is just one layer of insulation between those electronic devices and the can itself. So just a wrap of a plastic wrap or a plastic bag would be fine. The can itself doesn't have to be grounded, and in fact, it really shouldn't be for EMP. It's almost counterintuitive, but for lightning, you want to have everything grounded. For EMP, it's actually best to have things not grounded, including your Faraday cage, because anyone who's familiar with radio systems knows that your ground is half of your antenna, and you're actually creating an unintentional antenna by using a grounding strap.
Okay.
So you just wrap your electronic gear in plastic bags, put it in that can, and put the lid on tightly, and you have a pretty decent Faraday cage for less than $20.
Well, that's a good suggestion. Let me ask you about another product that I've often wondered about, and would it even work with your home system after an EMP attack, and that would be these portable solar generators. Do they have any utility in terms of an EMP
attack?
They do.
They have a great utility, but what I would recommend is if anyone buys any photovoltaic power system, that they make sure it's a standalone system that is not connected to grid power. If you buy a grid-tied system, you're basically leaving a entryway for EMP, because EMP can go right through the power lines. If you have a standalone system, the only unintentional antenna you're dealing with is the anywhere from 10 to 50 feet of cabling that's attaching your solar panels to your inverter box. That's the only, you're only going to have a very small, short antenna. But if you are hooked up to the power grid or you're hooked up to telephone lines, you're hooked up to an unintentional antenna that's gathering EMP over the course of hundreds of miles. So, again, you want to buy a independent photovoltaic power system, not one that's grid-tied. And I know that there are tax advantages to having a grid-tied system. There's cost advantages because you don't have to have batteries in the system. But from a self-sufficiency standpoint and from the standpoint of protecting yourself from EMP, you really need to have a bit more expensive system that's completely off-grid. And from a self-sufficiency standpoint, it's, of course, important to have a system with batteries, because when you buy a grid-tied system without batteries, it essentially is useless when there's no grid power.
Okay. And if someone was anticipating surviving an EMP attack and they have medical needs, let's say they're asthmatic and they need a breathing machine, or they have to have an insulin dispenser.
If you have a spare CPAP machine, or if you have a spare oxygen concentrator, for example, say people who have either sleep apnea or someone who needs medical oxygen, and they use typically now people don't use oxygen in tanks, they'll use what's called an oxygen concentrator. I highly recommend that if you have apnea and you have a CPAP machine, that you buy a spare, and that should be stored in a Faraday can.
Okay.
Because unfortunately they put microcircuits in just about everything nowadays. And
yeah,
by the same token,
do.
If you have an oxygen concentrator, you should buy a spare and put it in a Faraday can. And they're fairly inexpensive if you find either of them used on the secondary market, and the best place to find those would either be Craigslist or perhaps even FreeCycle. You might find one at FreeCycle.org where someone's just giving one away.
Okay. Let's talk about the geopolitics involved in this. I don't know if you've seen this or not. I suspect you have, that the Chinese now, or it's at least this is all over the net today, are training on American soil in a joint base.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see the Chinese wanting to perpetrate a EMP attack simply because of the fact that they own this country.
Right, and we're one of their biggest trading partners. And if they don't want to kill the goose that laid the golden egg. So I don't think it's in their best interest, at least as geopolitics stand right now, for them to do anything like that. Because if they destroy America and destroy our economy, their economy is going down with them. And China actually has a lot of unrest going on because of their own economic problems. There's a lot of strikes going on right now in China, and there's unfortunately their one-child policy that they had for 30-plus years is really coming back to bite them. There's a lot of young men in China who are out of work, and the one-child policy actually encouraged female infanticide. So there's a disproportionately large number of young men in the country. And traditionally, if you look at European history at least, if you have a surplus of young men wandering around without jobs, that usually spells revolution, or in the case of China, counter-revolution.
In your mind, could that be why the Chinese are building these massive but vacant ghost cities?
Well, they're trying desperately to keep their economy afloat, and they want to maintain close to full employment, and they're so desperate that, yes, I think they have the hopes that things will turn around, but what they're doing is creating their own mountains of debt. And if you think things are a little bit opaque with American finances and government finances, just try to look into China. It's impossible. It's an absolutely opaque system. We really have no idea of what level of indebtedness the Chinese government really has right now. And the extension of that, of course, is we have no idea about the solvency of the Chinese yuan, their currency. We really don't know. And I have a feeling that it probably won't come to full light until there is a global credit crisis. And at that point, not only will the American economy collapse, but so will the Chinese economy, because I think their hidden debt is actually much higher in terms of percentage of GDP.
Yeah, well, we have the same thing here, and let me make a case in point, and I suspect the same is true in China in a related fashion. Here in America, I've read that our unfunded mandated liabilities, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, is easily over $200 trillion. Some people
The official debt is around $19 trillion, but you're right, Dave. The long-term unfunded liabilities, and that includes all the pensions, Social Security, the whole works. If you add those all together, it's well in excess of $200 trillion, which means that in our real national debt is not 100% of GDP. It's more like 600 or 700% of GDP if you look at the long-term unfunded liabilities. We are an absolutely bankrupt nation. And go ahead, Dave.
I was going to say, I suspect the same thing is true in China, with their social support systems as well.
Yes, although they haven't really built up the same safety nets that we have, and they also don't have the same pension obligations, but their hidden debt is probably just as large as that in the United States. And here in the U.S., of course, they've been playing these games with quantitative easing, and officially we're between rounds of quantitative easing right now, but there's a lot of monkey business that's going on in international finance, where essentially we have worked out a swap agreement with at least one nation, and that's Belgium, to basically where we're buying each other's bad paper. So it's in effect just like quantitative easing never ended. Right now, the Belgians own more treasuries than their entire GDP. They own so many U.S. treasuries that it's essentially, it just boggles the mind to think that the Belgian government could do this, but obviously some backroom deal was made. So we're really living in the twilight zone of international finance at this point, and no currency can be trusted save precious metals. That's the only real currency out there, because all the fiat currencies that are in circulation are essentially worthless digits, and most of those aren't even physical paper anymore. They're just electronic digits floating out there. So people really need to protect themselves with precious metals and also any other practical, tangible, barterable items. And my favorite for that is common caliber ammunition.
Well, let's get into that situation. Let's assume that, you know, the Baltic Dry Index, which I'm sure you're familiar with, it's at an all-time low. It's below 500, and this goes off the cliff, and nothing's moving. Food's not moving. Nothing is moving. The stores are empty in 3 days. What are you going to be able to barter besides ammunition and gold?
Well, I actually prefer silver over gold for barter, just because gold is too compact a form of wealth for barter, at least for small transactions. I can't imagine what someone would be bartering a full 1 ounce gold coin for. I mean, that's like the equivalent of several months' salary. So if you want to go barter for a few cans of beans, you're really better off with a few circulated pre-1965 silver dimes in your pocket. It's much more practical for barter. But yeah, in a post-collapse world where we're reduced to barter, your very best bets will be, I believe, common caliber ammunition and easily recognizable silver coins in small denominations. And I think silver dimes and silver quarters are probably your best bet. Silver half dollars are fine, but the problem is they're a little bit more ambiguous, because most people realize that they were still made in 40% purity of silver after 1964, whereas with the dimes and quarters, we just basically went straight to copper slugs that are silver plated.
What would you say to people who are absolutely convinced it's not a matter of if, but when the economy collapses here in the United States?
I would say it's absolutely a certainty, simply because we have built up such enormous mountains of debt, both public and private, and it's mathematically impossible to pay that debt back, at least with the dollar holding any semblance of its current purchasing power. It is conceivable they could inflate their way out of the problem, basically the Zimbabwe effect, where they could start printing larger and larger denominations of bills. And in Zimbabwe, they got all the way up to a $100 trillion note, and those lasted all of about a week before they dropped in value to basically nothing. And that was the very last note they had before they just gave up on the currency completely, and they switched to doing transactions in either South African rand or U.S. dollars. So we could go through the same sort of thing here. And if that were to happen, virtually everyone's savings and basically every investment that people have that are denominated in dollars would be absolutely wiped out. And that's why...
The dollar is worthless. I mean, of course it would be wiped out. That means, this is what people don't even think about. They're retired. Their pensions are gone. Their savings accounts are gone. Everything is gone.
Right. And at that point, it'll all come down to productive farmland and practical, tangible barter items. Again, things like common caliber ammunition, firearms, perhaps gardening seed. So, you know, practical things that people can use will be the only thing that will hold their value while the dollar itself is in absolute freefall. Everyone else is going to be scrambling to spend their dollars as quickly as they can to put them into tangibles. But it'll be like catching a falling knife. It'll be very difficult for people to find anything of value that will hold its value to buy in that kind of environment, before the purchasing power of their dollars drops to pennies or less.
Well, we're speaking with James Wesley Rawls, and we're getting ready to go into the break. And when we come out of the break, we're going to talk about some of the daily realities when the dollar collapses. And I'm sure James is a lot like I am. I mean, I know it's going to happen, but I'm hesitant to really put a time frame on it. But I can see the end of the cliff coming up soon. Anyway, stay tuned. We'll be back with James Leslie Rawls after a word from these sponsors. Well, if you can't touch it, you don't own it. Those are the words of Steve Quayle, and we're talking about Renaissance precious metals. And you just heard our guest, James Wesley Rawls, talk about the fact that he prefers silver as a medium of exchange in a post-collapse economy. And Steve is ready, willing, and able to get you set up so you can be prepared as best as possible. I don't know that anyone can be totally prepared, but as best as possible, Steve will help you get ready. And I would encourage you to call him tomorrow, Renaissance Precious Metals, 406-586-4842. Excuse me. And I want to remind everybody that we still have our 6-month Same as Cash special available for all our Food for Liberty products, including our Grab and Go bag. 76 servings, delicious food. You'd think you're in a restaurant. I mean, I've pulled this out of my package. I've eaten them. They're fantastic. Reasonably priced. And as I said, 6 months Same as Cash. Can grab it, go. Never know when you're going to need to bug out. How do you get yours? foodforliberty.com/Hodges. Again, that is foodforliberty.com/Hodges. Well, our special guest is James Wesley Rawls, and we're talking about a number of things, but basically the theme is, what are we going to do when the lights go out? What are we going to do when the dollar is no longer saleable, no longer tradable, no longer usable? What can we do besides burn it in our fireplace? Well, James, one of the things I wanted to ask you about here is the geopolitical realities, continuity of government. You know, I think that when the dollar collapses, it's going to come like a thief in the night. I think we're going to go to bed on a Friday night, and by Monday morning, the banks are going to be closed. The grocery stores will start being emptied out. I mean, how do you see this? What's your scenario?
Well, I think you're right, Dave. It'll when it does come about, it'll happen very suddenly. And as my father used to say, there's three different types of people in the world: people who make things happen, people who watch things happen, and people who wonder, what the heck happened? And unfortunately, the majority of people are in that third category. And when we have an economic collapse, people will probably hear about a banking crisis or credit crisis going on, probably late in the week. And you're right, by Saturday, they are not going to have access to their ATMs. And by Monday, their banks won't be open. Their doors will physically not be opening. And we'll probably see the stock market in absolute free fall. And by the middle of the next week, we'll probably have word of wage and price controls. And then within a week or two after, we'll probably flip over from deflation to mass inflation and then hyperinflation. It could happen very, very quickly. It could all come unwound literally overnight. We could see just absolute chaos in all the markets, and people really need to protect themselves. They need to protect themselves physically. They need to protect their assets, and they need to protect their posterity.
I think they need to protect their six, and along those lines...
I guess people need to try to protect their posteriors as well as their posterity.
Very good, yes. Well, James, what about the personal security, continuity of government when the collapse comes? Is the government going to be able to maintain order?
I don't think so, no. If you look at large-scale disruptions, the ability of the government to react has been pitiful. If you look at what happened with Hurricane Katrina 10 years ago, for example, I'm fond of saying that FEMA actually stands for Foolishly Expecting Meaningful Aid, because FEMA really cannot respond, and it's not very well publicized, but FEMA's main mission is not disaster relief. It is actually continuity of government. That's their primary mission. Their secondary mission is disaster relief.
Interesting. Now, a lot of people don't realize that. So continuity of government is FEMA's function. How will life change for Americans with regard to government intervention, interaction with its people during a post-collapse of the dollar?
Well, life as we know it will change very, very radically, very quickly. And people need to develop networks for barter very quickly. I'm a big believer in the free market system, and I'm also a believer in the ability of markets to react and compensate for something even as great as a vacuum in a currency itself. Markets very quickly find equilibrium, and it'll be just a matter of a few days or perhaps at most a few weeks before everyone knows exactly what a silver dime or a silver quarter will buy, or what one box of 22 long rifle ammo will buy. That market equilibrium will be reached very quickly, and in urban areas, you know, people aren't even going to have the opportunity to barter because it'll be extremely dog-eat-dog. In the suburbs, perhaps, but certainly out in the countryside, I think people revert to a barter economy fairly quickly. And it's all going to come down to who you know and who you can trust. And you need to start forging those relationships now. If you don't know your neighbors well, you really need to go introduce yourself and get to know your neighbors. And for those of us who live in the countryside, it's really important to know what your neighbor's capabilities are in terms of who has medical skills, farming skills, traditional plumbing, wiring, timber framing, cabinet making kind of skills, who's worked with small and large livestock, and so forth. You really need to network with people now so that you'll know who you can depend on later. And you don't want to be approaching people as a stranger when everything falls apart. Times are going to be hard enough as it is. You don't want to have to go through that. You want to actually have at least a face recognition relationship with people, you know, for those of us who live in the country, with people in a 2 or 3 mile radius. You really need to get to know your friends and neighbors well. Make all your neighbors into friends, even those that you know, you right now might not have a lot in common with. It's really important that you get to know them. It's really time for people to stock up and team up and train up, because time is short.
Yeah, that's good advice. I am fortunate. I live pretty much out in the country. We're 20 miles away from civilization, living in a fairly traditional neighborhood, though. But we're on our own island, one way in, one way out. And we had to battle the forces of John McCain and the bankers to hang on to our property several years ago. So we are pretty tight-knit. But you're right. I don't know the capability of my neighbor. Now, most of us, I assume, have to shop in bulk like I do, because we don't want to make trips to the grocery stores very often because it's too far to drive.
Right. So I would assume that's one advantage of living in the country, yeah.
Exactly. So I think that most of my neighbors are probably pretty well stocked. I know some of them are armed, but it seems to me, and let me tell you, let me cut to a different side of this. I wrote to 20 different Block Watch organizations as an experiment this last summer.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't talked about this publicly yet because I was so disheartened by what I found. I suppose this is the time to reveal this. I only heard back from one of them, and here were the questions I asked. Yes, you do report suspicious people and so forth and so on, but what have you done for community defense? What if your power were to go down in an EMP attack and would not come back? What if this country were to be thrown into a nuclear war, but your community was lucky enough to survive? How would you defend yourselves from the ravaging hordes? Have you thought about this with your community block watch? Only one of those 20 wrote me back, and they said, you know, it's funny, we talked about the EMP, but we never did anything with it. We are so woefully unprepared, it's unbelievable.
Yeah, it's a sad state of affairs, Dave. We have a very pampered society, and when we do have a reckoning day, whether it's a physical natural disaster or whether it's a economic collapse or perhaps even a pandemic or a solar flare, it doesn't matter what, but when the power grids go down, all bets will be off.
It's amazing. You know, there's a questionnaire that's floating around the public schools. And this started, I think, either 2 or 3 years ago. And I know it's in more than just in Arizona where I live. I've heard from people from Georgia and Florida. And it goes like this. They get the teachers, the administrators, and the other staff members are getting a questionnaire. And in the questionnaire, they ask you what your skills are. And they start off with things I think everybody agrees with would be important, and what you just mentioned. You know, do you have EMT skills? You know, anybody here have a first aid card? Do you know how to do basic carpentry and repair work? And then they get into heavy-duty construction skills. I mean, they run the whole gamut from what you'd want to help in a short-term crisis to skills that would be needed to rebuild an institution or even a community. Why are the schools involved in this, and why is DHS pushing this to the schools?
Interesting. That, as they say, Dave, is food for thought and grounds for further research.
Do you have an educated guess?
I wouldn't be surprised if FEMA was behind this. If they were the one, if they may not be the official organization circulating these questionnaires, but I have a feeling that they help structure this, and they are the actual intended recipient of all the data.
But why through the schools? Are they planning to use these schools as community safe havens?
Well, the schools for many, many years have been considered rallying points in the event of a disaster. Most National Guard units and most Army Reserve units actually have schools, typically elementary schools or junior high schools, for example, as their secondary mobilization center in the event of a disaster that would wipe out their Army Reserve centers. And they've actually, I used to be a mobilization officer for an Army Reserve unit. And in the event of a nuclear attack, I know it sounds pretty far-fetched, but our contingency plan was to have our mobilization take place at an elementary school 35 miles away in a more remote, in a farming area. It's kind of far-fetched to think that our soldiers would actually be able to get there in the event of a nuclear attack, but that was our contingency plan. So because of the way American schools are built, even though they're not built as boarding schools, they still have cafeterias, they still have a nursing office, they still have an intercom system, that they often have a backup generator. They're actually fairly suitable for use as relocation centers in the event of a disaster. And often when there is a localized disaster, it's the Red Cross will set up relocation centers at mm-hmm. schools.
Yes, they do. Yeah, I've seen that particularly in communities where there are forest fires and they have to evacuate people in outlying areas, and they do often relocate them into the local school. So I've clearly seen that. So that does make a great deal of sense, but it's interesting that some of the skills they were inventorying had to do more with construction skills rather than maintenance skills, and I thought that was a very interesting tidbit.
That is indicative, Dave, yes.
Well, this kind of takes you in. We've kind of almost gone full circle now in a 365 manner, and let's go back to the EMP attack and situation, because people could actually be marooned at schools, couldn't they?
Yes, and in fact, it's just as important for people to have a get-home bag as it is to have a bug-out bag or a get-out-of-dodge kit, as I call it. You never know when a disaster might strike, and if it's something like EMP or an X-class solar flare, there may not be a lot of warning. There may have, you know, with a solar flare, there may have been talk about it for the previous day, but they may not talk about the severity of it. And next thing you know, you have something on the order of a Carrington event where it's a very high-level X-class solar flare, and that could have essentially the same effect as EMP on one entire hemisphere of the planet that's facing the sun.
Interesting. Well, I work 28 miles from, at least for one of my job sites, 28 miles one way. And you're talking about a get-home bag. What do I need other than the Bible to pray for my lost rear end?
Well, a lot of it will depend on your climate. If you live in a cold climate, it's important that people have a heavy jacket, gloves, a pile cap, a sleeping bag, and so forth. But even for people in a hot climate, it's really important that you have a very sturdy set of shoes, extra socks. You want to have water, food, some means of self-defense, depending on the legalities of where you live. In Arizona, you're blessed to be in an open carry state and a permitless concealed carry state, so you've got an ideal situation to be able to carry a firearm in your get-home bag. But you just have to think it through in terms of the distance you need to cover, your stage of life, and the distance with and the amount of time it takes to cover that distance. I'm a big believer in folding bicycles. Here at our ranch, we have a folding bicycle made by a company called Montague, and they fold quite compactly. And for someone who commuted a long distance every day, I would seriously consider, if you drive any decent-sized vehicle, say a mid-sized car or a small SUV, always carrying a folding bicycle with you, because that will make a huge difference in the amount of ground that you can cover if you're in a situation where your vehicle is not available.
What are the dimensions?
Basically, just a little bit bigger than a bicycle wheel in width, and maybe a foot taller than the bicycle wheel in height once it's folded.
So
basically,
I'm trying to get my mind
around this.
Wheels
are side by side when it's folded.
Okay.
And so you're still going to have a handlebar, but that can be turned 90 degrees, and you're going to still have a seat, but the seat can be lowered down to the frame level. So it's quite compact when folded.
So you could really get it down to almost 3 feet by 3 feet?
Yeah, a little bit less, actually, yes.
Oh, really? That's convenient. Then again, too,
And only about 10 inches thick.
Well, it seems to me, and this is something that I actually have thought of, we have a second home in the city that's 11 miles from where I would most likely be during that time, which is certainly a lot more manageable than 28 miles.
Right.
But the problem is I have to go through a suburban-urban environment to get to it.
Ooh,
and,
yeah.
And that'll be the challenge.
Dave, people need to tailor their preparations to their own personal situation,
yes,
their own health conditions, their stage of life, and the environment they live in. For someone like me who lives out in a remote area, my main concern will be environmental. For someone in an urban area, their main concern will be keeping themselves alive. It's the two-legged predators they're going to worry about. Out here, I worry about bears, the four-legged predators. So if someone is in a situation where they need to get back home, it might actually be in their best interest to wait until after nightfall so they can travel under cover of darkness and then have a number of routes picked out where they're on back roads to be able to get home. You definitely don't want to be on any major thoroughfares.
That is a really interesting set of advice, because I've seen the same thing in a lot of these survival videos that are out there about stay off the main thoroughfares. And you talked about going at night, so this brings up the subject, how important is night vision?
Night vision is probably one of the most overlooked areas of preparedness and one of the most crucial, because essentially you're only going to have decent security for your home or ranch for daylight hours without it. You really need to have at least one very high-quality night vision scope. My favorite is the ANPVS-14, which is a night vision monocular,
right,
that can be worn three different ways. It can be worn, well, you carry it as a monocular. You can put it on a head harness or a helmet mount. Or it can be attached to a weapons mount and put coaxially in line with a red dot scope that can be dialed way, way down to a very dim light. And in the case of like an EOTech scope, for example, you need to get what they call an NV or night vision compatible EOTech that can be dialed way, way down, because any standard red dot, when you're looking at it through a night vision scope, would be absolutely overwhelm the your vision because of the light amplification provided by the scope. So you need something that can be dialed way, way down to a very dim light. And then that you can take a night vision scope like a PVS-14 that does not have its own reticle, but you line it up behind a night vision or a red dot scope, and that gives you an aiming point.
Well, that's the couple of things you just mentioned there I've never thought of. In particular, let's talk about the helmet mount. So what kind of helmet are you talking about, and does it slide over?
I'm talking like a standard U.S. Army Kevlar helmet, or any of the new generation of Kevlars. And that is a helmet called there's also a vehicle crewman helmet, but the one for ground troops is called a MITCH, which is a modular, what's it stand for? I can't recall what MITCH stands for. It's modular crew helmet, I think is what it stands for. That is basically a lightweight version of the traditional Kevlar helmet. But most of the Kevlar helmets that have been produced in the last, say, 12 to 15 years have a night vision night vision mount tab in the front, and that tab is a swing-down mount for a PVS-14. So if you buy any of those helmets, you can mount a PVS-14 quite easily. You can also retrofit older helmets, but it's kind of a kludge to do it that way. You're actually better off getting one of the later generation helmets.
Okay, and anything like, I've always envisioned, you know, some of these night vision, they might come in the form of goggles.
Well, goggles are nice because you have stereo vision, which gives you depth perception.
Right.
The problem with goggles is you have to power two night vision tubes, and those are about $1,500 a piece. So it's great for an Army aviator who can afford, you know, it's Uncle Sam buying him a $10,000 pair of night vision goggles. But for most of us, the simple method and one that provides much greater battery life is a single night vision tube binocular. Again, you don't have depth perception with one, so you couldn't do something like flying a helicopter with just a binocular. But it's decent for driving a vehicle. The crucial thing is you need to learn to leave a lot longer braking distance between you and the next vehicle ahead of you in a convoy, or just in traffic. You need to because your night vision will be there, but your depth perception won't be. So you need to take that into account and compensate with more braking distance.
Objects are closer than they appear to be.
Yes, indeed.
Okay. We're talking to James Leslie Rawls from SurvivalBlog.com. And James, let's take a moment here before we close with my last question that I know you're going to want to elaborate on at some length. But tell people how they can follow your good work.
Well, sure. I, for the last 10 years, have been posting a blog at SurvivalBlog.com. It's all free of charge. We have very deep archives with in excess of 30,000 archived articles and letters. It's all fully searchable and free of charge. I recommend that people take full advantage of it and research their family preparedness subjects, again, at survivalblog.com. I've also published several books, a couple of which are actually digests from my blog. So if someone's on an incredibly tight budget, they can just go to a library and bring up survivalblog.com and start printing out the crucial articles for them, but at least put the most important articles in hard copy, and then perhaps build a slightly larger library on a memory stick. Now, for folks who want to read my books, I've published the Patriots novel series, and I've published two nonfiction books from Penguin Books. One is called How to Survive the End of the World as We Know It, and more recently, the book Tools for Survival. And on December 1st, I have the first book in my new novel series, which is called The Counter-Caliphate Chronicles. That first book is called Land of Promise. That'll be coming out December 1st, both as a Kindle book and in paperback.
Very good. You're just like a one-stop shop here. It's amazing what's on your website. I went there, and it's almost like acquiring a drug addiction, because one thing leads to another, and you find yourself an hour later, and you can't get off the blog. Let me close with this, because we got about 2.5-3 minutes left in this particular segment. But people come to you and say, James, okay, I'm not prepared at all. I've got modest income. I'm not broke, but I have modest income. Give them a few things they can do generally to increase their chances of survival for the scenarios we've set forth.
Well, I think water, of course, is paramount. Every family needs to have a good quality water filter. In fact, two. They should have a big Berkey, and they should have, or a Berkey clone, for high volumes of water in a fixed location. And they should also have a compact water system, like a Katahdin, a pocket filter, for example, or a combi filter. Those are excellent, and that's what you want to carry in your bug-out bag or in your get-home bag. Water is paramount. Beyond that, of course, food storage and all the other key areas of preparedness that I discuss in my blog. For any newbies, I recommend that they visit survivalblog.com, and in the left-hand bar, there's a link that's marked Getting Started, and that will bring up a newbies page. And it'll go through kind of a checklist of the things that people need to consider for preparedness. And for your listeners who are a little bit more advanced at preparedness, in that left-hand bar, there's another link that's marked List of Lists. If they click on that, that'll bring up an Excel spreadsheet that will definitely open people's eyes to the extent of the preparedness steps they need to take. and it's fairly well organized and it's fairly comprehensive. Again, that's List of Lists, and that's in the left-hand bar at survivalblog.com.
Well, that is just a phenomenal set of preparation offerings that you're making there, and I really appreciate so much you having this. It really for people at different levels of their preparation, and it's interesting how you're saying to have two water filters, which makes perfect sense. What about water drums with purification tablets? Would you recommend that as well?
Yes, that they do work. They take quite a while to take effect, though. For a chlorine-based or iodine-based water purification tablet, you need to let the water sit and actually agitate it would be better for at least 30 minutes, preferably closer to an hour. And if you're in a get-out-of-dodge situation, you may not have an hour to sit around, but you can certainly carry some water purification tablets as well. But with something like a combi filter or even just a life straw, you can stick that into water that you could barely see through and be instantly drinking water that's perfectly safe to drink.
Yeah, because I know in an EMP scenario, when I read the Naval War College assessment, they said that the biggest challenge for people after the initial violence and fight for resources will be avoiding waterborne diseases. So to me, that went right to the top of my preparation list when I read that. I have to tell you, this has been fascinating. We're going to have you on because we barely scratched the surface of so many things I wanted to ask. But our time is up for this segment, James, and I want to thank you so much for being our guest for the first time here on the Common Sense Show.
Thank you so much, Dave. God bless you and your listeners.
Thank you, sir. Well, ladies and gentlemen, James Wesley Rawls, and his website that you can visit is survivalblog.com. And I'm going to tell you from experience, if you go there, be prepared to stay for a while. We'll be back on the other side with my friend Mike Adams and my partner, James White.
On Facebook, on the news, and in conversations with friends, we're bombarded every day with advice on how to be healthier, from gluten-free and non-GMO diets to how much exercise and sleep the body needs. But how much have you heard about alkalizing the body? AlkaVision Plasma pH Drops are a holistic and natural way to get your body's pH levels back in balance. Just a few drops in water will help your body rid itself of harmful waste, and even the healthiest of diets can be complemented with your daily use of AlkaVision Plasma pH Drops. Who isn't looking for more vibrance, vigor, and energy? Now buy two bottles of AlkaVision Plasma pH Drops and get $10 off your order. Visit AlkaVision.com or call 800-518-7615. AlkaVision Plasma pH Drops are packed with a powerful combination of the most alkaline minerals and compounds. Open the door to greater health, vitality, and zest for life. Alkalize your body. Supercharge your health. Call 800-518-7615 or head to AlkaVision.com.
This is the Global Star Radio Network.